welcome to Dakota Midday for this Wednesday. I'm Kara Hetland, broadcasting from the studios at the University of Sioux Falls. And coming up, we'll meet author Brian Evenson, and we'll also spend a little bit of time remembering former Governor Walter Dale Miller. But first, it's time for the Dakota Political Junkies. Joining me this week, Roger Whittle, the managing editor at the Watertown Public Opinion. Roger, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And also Jonathan Ellis, reporter and columnist with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. Thanks for being here as well.
Happy to be here.
So let's start and share with me your memories of former Governor Walter Dale Miller.
Roger, you go for that because you were
Roger,
here.
Roger, you were here, right?
Yeah.
Well, actually, I was not, but
okay.
I do remember the day it happened when the plane crash happened. Walter Dale Miller took over the governorship under some pretty bad circumstances, and I know the whole state was shaken up when that happened. And by all accounts, he did a really good job. He was the steady hand that the state needed at the time. Got a lot of good reviews for his work, and as being a calm taskmaster kind of guy, he had a few problems that he tackled during his term: the prison riot, there was some flooding, and pretty much got high marks. So I think he was basically a good guy that I haven't really heard a bad word about since his passing.
The calm in the storm. Jonathan, you were what, elementary school?
No. No, I do remember. You know, I wasn't living in South Dakota in that day, and I do recall actually driving in my car. So I was at least high school age. And hearing about the governor of South Dakota's plane crash, and of course that was overshadowed by what was going on down in Waco at that time. But you know, Governor Miller did get very high marks from his staffers, from people, for coming into office, in a very difficult time, leading the state government. He more than likely would have been reelected had Bill Janklow not reemerged. But besides the fact that he was almost an accidental governor, I guess, but he was a skilled politician well before that, and that's one of the reasons why George Mickelson had included him on the ticket back in 1986. He had a good West River presence. He had been in the state legislature for a very long time. Had held all these leadership offices there. He had been an early Ronald Reagan supporter, as early as the 1970s, well before Reagan won the presidency in 1980. He's established with the George Bush family. So I mean, he had these contacts that were pretty interesting for a guy who just been sort of a state lawmaker. So, a very skilled politician. He carried a lot of gravitas with him in the West River area, and that was again one of the reasons why I think George Mickelson put him on the ticket.
Jonathan, let's move on to the Gear Up program. You had an article recently about what's happening with that. So give us a little bit of background.
Well, we're still working on some issues with that. It's kind of an ongoing deal, and I know that we're not the only media organization to be working on that. But as we know, that Gear Up program had been the state terminated the contract with a longtime cooperative that had run that contract. And then we had, of course, within hours of that, we had this horrible apparently murder-suicide in Platt. So some people think somehow that all of that is linked. We've looked at the program a little bit, and we looked at the event most recently. We looked at the most recent evaluation of the program and whether or not it was, meeting benchmarks of where it was supposed to be. And keep in mind now, this program started in 2005, so it's about a decade old. And they're not, they were missing out on about a dozen or so benchmarks in terms of bringing. And I should explain, the program is in trying to get Native American middle schoolers and high schoolers ready for college or post-secondary education. And the most recent evaluation would show that they're sort of lagging in some pretty key areas in terms of, fulfilling that goal. And the state, of course, when they terminated that contract, they included a letter, to the co-op indicating that they weren't getting the job done. And there was also some concerns about financial issues in terms of some audits that irregularities or some accounting problems. So that's kind of where we stand right now in that issue.
Still trying to figure out if it's all related?
Well, that's, I think, where everybody is. I think, you know, us in the media world, I think, certainly investigators and DCI, I mean, everybody's looking. You know, one of the things that I think we're looking into is how the Gear Up program had the contract with the co-op and how other nonprofits were also involved in this organization. That included the business manager, you know, who committed these crimes, apparently. So I think everybody's looking at those relationships, and I certainly one of the reasons that the contract was terminated was for, quote, conflicts of interest, according to the letter from the Education Secretary, Melody Schaub.
Roger Whittle, anything to add?
Well, I'd like to ask Jonathan a question about this.
Go for it. I don't know if I can answer it, but go ahead.
Anything that you found out so far in your investigation would point to something as bad as the reaction that we got from the news? I mean, this guy took out his whole family and himself, and on the surface of it, he, you know, lost a contract. It doesn't seems to be a little disconnect there between the action and the reaction.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, no, there's not any indication that something was so awful that you would do this. There's just nothing there yet that I've seen. And even talking on background with people who, you know, there's currently an audit ongoing, and that's, again, one of the that has not, to the best of my knowledge, been released publicly. But even people who are familiar with that audit have said, you know, even in the worst case scenario, you'd never imagine this happening. So there is this huge disconnect, and maybe at the end of the day, it was just a coincidence that the contract was lost, and then that this happens a few hours later. So, you know, that's hopefully what everybody is trying to get to the bottom of.
Do you think we'll ever really know?
I think we could. I don't know. I mean, it's possible. I think we could. You know, and I obviously. You know, when you're an investigator, a law enforcement investigator, you have access, certainly far more access to records that media people don't. You have access to banking account records and things like that. And certainly I would expect that that's what the DCI is looking into.
Okay. Roger, let's move on to the next topic and talk a little bit about Governor Dugard testifying today, having meetings yesterday in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, he has joining some about 30 other states that are deciding that we're fighting expansion of Medicaid in their states, have now apparently changed their mind a little bit and are discussing plans with the federal government to expand Medicaid. In South Dakota, that would affect almost 50,000 people, I believe I read. And supposedly, this new plan wouldn't cost the state very much money at all because they would find savings through other things. But it should be interesting to follow this because it was our governor was pretty adamant in the beginning that he was not going to expand Medicaid. But if he can do it without costing the state any money, he's willing to do it. So it's a good thing.
So do we know details of this plan, Jonathan?
You know, we don't know a lot of the details of the plan. I think that they're holding back a little bit on what the details are. You know, it's interesting to note that this isn't the first run that South Dakota has had at trying to expand the program in a version that was less generous than, I suppose, the one that passed under the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, those previous attempts were rejected. Basically, instead of expanding it for people who are at 138% or below the poverty limit, the state had attempted to set the bar at 100%, and that was rejected in the past. So it'll be interesting to see what the new proposal is. I mean, there have been some other states that have expanded Medicaid under plans that weren't exactly as they had been spelled out in the Affordable Care Act. So it's possible that they've looked at some of those how other states have done that, and maybe adopted something similar, a plan that way. But you know, the cost of full blown expansion has always been the governor's concern. I mean, even though the federal government will eventually pick up 90% of the costs for expansion, it would still cost the state, tens of millions of dollars to expand, and that's been Governor Dugard's chief concern.
Well, he's always said he wasn't saying never. He's just saying not now. So, they've presented plans and they've been rejected. So do you think he's backing down a little? Is he getting some heat, do you think, Roger Whittle, from people in South Dakotans to do this?
I don't think he's been getting particularly a lot of heat from anybody in the state. I just think if it works out that he can do this without harming the budget, he's willing to do that. And I think that is not really a change from his earlier stance where he didn't want to spend the money to do it. So I don't think he's been under any pressure at all. I could be wrong, though.
I would say that the healthcare industry in particular has been interested in seeing the expansion. I mean, they've been, besides Democrats, the healthcare industry has been the chief proponents of expanding, simply because they end up writing off a lot of CARES charity care for people who aren't in the program. So I don't know that they've necessarily put a lot of pressure in, but they've made it known that yes, they would like to see expansion. And of course, as you indicated, the governor's never said never, they made various attempts over the last couple of years to find an alternative that would, I think, probably, not be as expensive as how the program was spelled out to be expanded in the Affordable Care Act. So, I think if the governor can do that, but the next question comes back to whether or not this is something the governor thinks he can do on his own, or does he need the legislature? I mean, this is an issue that's playing out in Alaska, where, if I have it correct, the Alaska governor just simply expanded, and now you've got the legislature suing the governor, saying he didn't have the authority to do that. So, I mean, there could be still more drama yet in all of this.
Which is why the plan hasn't completely been released, probably doesn't want to unless he knows the federal government will accept it.
But that could be one reason, and maybe, they're still kind of, you would think that they would have a pretty formulated plan if they've gone to the federal government, but maybe they've just sort of outlined some areas and they're going to fill in the details later.
Okay. Flandreau and the marijuana resort. What's your take? What do you know? We'll start with Jonathan.
Well, basically, the Justice Department has sort of softened its stance on because there are states that are moving to legalize even recreational use, and certainly in other states the medicinal use. The Justice Department has sort of kind of given tribes the green light to have some recreational marijuana, and Flandreau is the first tribe in the country to really kind of seize upon the opportunity that presents. And they hope to have an operation, sort of a nightclub-type place where you could go and it'll be entertainment, and you could go and buy some recreational marijuana and use it there. They hope to have something going by the end of the year. They think, and I think they're correct, that it would attract some tourism dollars, and from an economic development point of view, would probably be very good on a certain level.
Make a little more money with this than with gambling, do you think, with casinos, Roger?
They have a pretty nice casino down there. I don't know. I think they'd be very happy if they could match the amount of money they're making with this venture with what they bring in from their casino. But I think this is just another step in the acceptance of marijuana in the United States. I mean, it's already legal in some states, and those states haven't, fallen into chaos for any reason, and the money is good. So I think you're going to see more and more of this kind of thing. It's interesting that the very first native marijuana resort is going to be pretty much in our own backyard, about halfway between Sioux Falls and Watertown. It'll be really interesting to see how this plays out. They have some nice plans. I mean, they're going to have a concert venue. Eventually, they're going to have an actual casino where there'll be slot machines in this marijuana resort. So they've been putting some thought into it. They've already have their growing operation up and running, and they say the crop will be ready by New Year's Eve.
Jonathan, I cut you off. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. I don't know how much, if it's going to be as big as the casino or not. Roger's right that, I mean, people are more accepting of marijuana, I guess. And I mean, to put it into my perspective on it, I mean, marijuana has been classified by the federal government for decades as a class one drug, which is on par with heroin. I mean, and that's just crazy. I mean, that's just insane. And I think people really started to realize it's just ridiculous. I mean, it's a ridiculous use of resources and part of this drug war that we've been fighting for decades. And so, you know, I think people have realized that it's just becoming that's not a place where they want to put tax resources.
But isn't there a risk with a new administration and they could change the policy? Administration could change this policy for Native Americans?
That is a risk. I mean, you've had some of the Republican contenders, Chris Christie, most notably, former prosecutor, say he would end these experiments, not only in the reservations, but in the states that have voted to legalize. And then you have some other Republicans who are more along the lines of Federalists, who think that the states should be kind of allowed to go forth and go on with this experiment. But you're no doubt about it, Kara. There's a huge risk that a new administration would reverse that on day one.
Any chances, any predictions about the South Dakota legislature bringing this up to legalize marijuana in South Dakota, or at least industrial hemp?
Well, I know the tribe has actually scheduled a tour of their facility for legislatures coming up pretty soon, which would be an interesting thing to tag along on. But I think you're going to find industrial hemp will probably be given the green light here. There's as ridiculous as the marijuana rules are, considering it, you know, calling it, like Jonathan said, on the par with heroin. Industrial hemp is no different than wheat when it comes to that. So I think you're going to see that become legal in South Dakota, if not this session, pretty soon.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for taking time and coming on Dakota Midday today. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Political Junkies' Roger Whittle, the managing editor at the Watertown Public Opinion, and Jonathan Ellis, reporter and columnist with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader, joining us today. And when we come back, we'll spend some time remembering former Governor Walter Dale Miller. You're listening to Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.